This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hello and welcome to today's Positive Parenting Show. I'm Armin Brott. Just recently, the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development finished up a 15-year exhaustive study on 1,364 kids. Their conclusions were pretty straightforward. Children who spent 100% of their time being cared for by their mothers did no better than kids who spent time in childcare. And they defined the phrase childcare pretty broadly and included all kinds of non-maternal care. So that would be anything from center-based or family daycare to babysitters or nannies. The study's key message is pretty straightforward as well. Childcare is not the thing to worry about. How you parent is. In fact, kids in high-quality childcare have higher cognitive and language skills than other kids, including those with at-home mom. Children in high-quality childcare also score better on tests of school readiness in terms of literacy and numbers. The bottom line here is that families thrive not in spite of working mothers, but because of them. But the whole key here is to tap into your best resource and your most powerful ally, and that is your spouse. And the starting point is an attitude shift that puts you and your spouse on a road to 50-50. That's a road where parents who want to get ahead in their careers can do that, and they can still get to their children's soccer games. I'm Armin Brott. We'll talk about how to get to 50-50 in a way that works for everybody after this.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
Looking for the best all-you-can-eat buffet for only $1.99? Come to Big Ed's Chow House. But if you're looking for Big Ed, don't come to Big Ed's Chow House. Big Ed passed away last week at 47, leaving his wife and children struck down in his prime by the same disease that got his father, so he won't be around for his family. And sadly, it could have been detected early with a simple test, but Big Ed didn't get it.
Have you gotten the medical test you need? For a list of tests every man should have, go to AHRQ.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Sharon Mears, who's the co-author of Getting to 50-50, How Working Parents Can Have It All. Sharon, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Armin.
So let's make sure we're on the same page as far as what 50-50 means. I think a lot of people see the phrase 50-50 or they hear the word equality, and they think, okay, well, you're going to change 12 diapers and I'll change 12 diapers, or you're going to make the X number of meals and I'll do the same thing. But equality and 50-50 doesn't necessarily mean exactly the same on both sides, right?
Absolutely. You know, we put that idea out there in part just to get people to have a shorthand for people to talk about this. And
right.
It's clearly not 50-50 every day in anyone's life. It could be 90-10 or 60-40. And, you know, and certainly in my life, it changes all the time. I think the point is it's a mindset that says that kids need their relationship with their fathers as much as they need their relationship with moms, and women need their jobs as much as men do.
You know, you had an interesting thing. I just am trying to find the page again. I marked it, and of course, my mark fell out. But it was about talking to boys and girls about the advantages of being the other, and that girls felt that there was an advantage to being a boy because they would have better careers and that kind of thing. And the boys were not seeing that there was a whole lot of advantage to being a girl. And you made a connection between that and careers. How do you make that leap?
Well, I think, you know, the things that have been traditionally female roles around nurturing, you know, are obviously hugely important. They're not only important to the well-being of children and families, but if you go and look at what business schools are saying these days, it's also good. There are good qualities to have in managers, which probably 50 years ago we didn't spend a lot of time talking about. So, but I think historically, the traits that we associate with girls have been portrayed to boys as being things that they don't do, and, you know, boys don't cry, and boys are in general, even in today's modern world less encouraged to express emotion.
Right.
And so you know, those issues sort of build up over time and get more extreme as kids become teenagers and go into the work world. So if men over time, you know, people like Gloria Steinem have said things like, we've made it clear that girls can do what boys can do. Women can be aggressive. They can be leaders. But we still haven't gotten totally comfortable with the idea that we should teach boys to do what women have done, which is look after children, be nurturing, be gentle, and express emotion.
We've also, I think, given boys a little bit of a different message about than girls. I think if you look at some of the surveys that I'm sure you've seen them, asking kids who are a little bit older than the ones you're talking about before about roles further out in life. And a lot of boys and girls look at being the provider, protector as kind of the primary thing for boys or for young men, and less so for girls. And I think that girls can see an option of staying home with the kids or possibly not working, and that's not an option that's open to boys at all. Well, it is. I mean, yes, it is open, but it's not one that gets talked about too terribly much.
Absolutely. And I think that one of the things that we say is let's say the same thing to our sons that we say to our daughters. I happen to have a son and a daughter, and so I try to live this as much as possible, which is, you know, I want my son to believe that he has a responsibility to find some way of making a living where he can look after himself and look after a family. But I want my daughter to feel the same way. I think, I've certainly seen lots of circumstances. I even grew up in a circumstance where my dad did a lot of public interest work, was a psychologist. And, the need to earn a living was seen to be entirely his job. And that meant it really limited the kinds of career choices he could make. So not so good for men necessarily to feel like it's only their job to pay for the family. And similarly, you know, one of the things I think we don't talk about a lot is what a burden it is for women to be constantly asking to believe that it's a choice whether to work or not. We interviewed hundreds of working parents, and the women who seemed happiest were the women who were quite convinced that working was not really a choice. It was as much their obligation as it was for any man. And if you believe that, then you just figure out how to make it work so it's great for your kids and great for your spouse and great for the whole family.
You know, I was talking with my sister about this just last night, interestingly enough, about one of my kids who's floundering somewhat. She's having difficulty keeping jobs, and she's only 20, so it's not the end of the world. But talking about the self-esteem issue that's associated with women and working, and whether, I guess I'd like to hear from a different female perspective, from yours in particular, and from the women that you researched, how important is a job to a woman's self-esteem? Or looking at it from a different perspective, does it make her feel bad about herself to be put in a position where she's not able to, where she's not really self-sufficient, not able to take care of herself?
So I think the psychology research that we got to look at, we had the opportunity to talk to and meet with a whole bunch of people involved in the largest research ever on childcare and child development. And where that relates to your question is that one of the largest factors, obviously, in the well-being of a child is the happiness of the parents and how that reflects in the experience of the child.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently it's been true for 40-odd years that when parents pull themselves entirely out of the workforce, whether they be women or men, the risk of depression can go up as much as 10 to 30%. That's pretty material.
That's big, yeah.
And so there's also some huge research out of the UK where, you know, they have the public health system, and they looked at 50,000 women. This is profiled in the first chapter of our book. And the women with the highest self-esteem and sense of well-being and ultimately physical health were the women who both were parents and had jobs. So there's something really fundamental. It's true for men. You know, Freud said it, that it's important to have both meaningful emotional connections, but also meaningful work where you can have another source of self-esteem. And I think more and more we're realizing that that's true for women, too.
Yeah, it seems like we haven't done men a whole lot of good by having us kind of see our value in terms of our work. And I'm wondering if that's a message. Do you want to go that far with women to have them feel the same way, that their whole identity is tied up in their jobs? Or do we need to be whittling away at the poor messages we've dealt to men as well?
Yeah, I think we have this incredible opportunity in our generation for a total reset, right? You know, when people say things like, you know, I've worked in some pretty competitive environments in my life, mostly male environments, both in investment banking and now technology. And, you know, there's historically been this requirement that people say that work comes before family in environments like that. But in truth, what person do you know who you would respect and think is emotionally helpful, who would truly put a work concern over a serious interest of their child or their family? It doesn't make sense, right? It makes sense. At the end of the day, the people we are accountable for are our children and our families, and whether that's true if you're a man or if you're a woman. And I think, you know, historically, we have asked men to pretend you know, a fantasy life that you can actually outsource looking after children and emotional connections to somebody else. And more, I think what's wonderful about women coming into the workplace is they shake that up a little bit and say, you know, that's just not right. We can do a really good job at work and also be good to our families. And with men coming into family life more and more, I think they bring a perspective that is also balancing. It helps women lighten up maybe a little bit about our roles as parents and how particular we have to be.
My guest is Sharon Mears, who is the co-author with Joanna Strober of Getting to 50-50, How Working Parents Can Have It All. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue our fascinating discussion so far with Sharon Mears about all sorts of things having to do with getting to 50-50, whether 50-50 is possible, some of the obstacles that women can throw in the way of men and that men can throw in the way of women, myths about work and family, and solutions, of course, solutions, what we can do about all of this. I'm Armin Brandt, and you're listening to Positive Parenting.
There once was a boy wizard whose name was Larry Smarter.
Larry, why weren't you in Professor Dinky Doodle's mythical creature classification class?
Well, I'm taking Algebra 2 in a foreign language.
Oh, so you can talk to unicorns?
Exactly. Unless they're French.
Larry wanted to go to college, so he visited knowhowtogo.org to find the classes he really needed. Getting into college doesn't happen magically. Learn more at knowhowtogo.org.
Brought to you by the American Council on Education, Lumina Foundation for Education, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brandt. Continuing our discussion, if you just happen to be joining us, with Sharon Mears, who's the co-author of Getting to 50-50, How Working Parents Can Have It All. Before we went on the air, Sharon, you were talking about the idea of women kind of being gatekeepers and how that's a message that's getting a little bit more traction these days. I remember I first came across that concept. I did a book with a guy, you probably know this, Ross Park, who was one of the big fatherhood researchers. And he was way out in front of a lot of this stuff and told me as we were working together that one of his conclusions, which sounded awfully harsh, was that men will be as involved with their kids as their wives will let them be. And he kept showing me all sorts of research about this. And it was never a question that it's malicious. But there are these subtle little things that women can do, I think partly because we fed them this message, sort of similar to men, your identity is tied up in your jobs. We've fed women the same kind of message about women, your identity is tied up in being a mom or being the primary caretaker. How do you get this across to people in a way that doesn't insult them and gets them to maybe say, okay, I'll see what I can do about changing that?
Great question. And Ross Park is correct. There's just unbelievable amounts of evidence that women can play a huge role in welcoming men into parenting, and that completely changes the dynamic. You know, one of the things we say is that if you go to any dinner party or female coffee clutch, you will hear somebody talking about how they wish their husband would do more with the kids and wondering why they don't. And almost invariably, you will hear that same person talking about the various different things their husband doesn't do well.
Right, right.
Well, it's very, very difficult. One of the things that we think about a lot is, you know, if I were planning a trip with my sister, I would not assume that I was going to make all the decisions. Or if I'm planning a project with a peer at work, I also assume that if I want their partnership, they are going to have half the ideas and kind of how their ideas have to turn out to be part of what we do. That's kind of how you get buy-in, and it's also hopefully how you get some pretty good ideas. But strangely, we don't take that norm home because women in general have been raised through babysitting and, you know, things we've learned from our aunts and grandmothers and other wonderful people, that women have some inherent set of instincts that are better than male instincts about kids. And, you know, I'm pretty convinced from the research and now from experience and getting to talk to lots of parents that we just need to put that aside. And the more that women can say, you know, maybe I'm good at X and Y, maybe I'm even better than my spouse, but in the interest of our being happy partners, figuring out how to serve our kids as parents, I need to embrace my husband's ideas as valid as my own.
Oh, that's absolutely true. Yeah, I think some of this has to do with the way that we define certain words, the things like nurturing. We define it in kind of a female way, that what guys do with their kids is just as nurturing and compassionate and caring, but it's not the same sort of thing. I mean, I remember just as a young kid, some of the most intimate moments I ever had, or that felt I was connecting with my father the most, were when we were 50 yards apart and throwing a baseball back and forth. That was nurturing, I thought. But if we define it in a particular way, then we're kind of defining men out of the equation. And if we're defining success at work as kind of the way that tends to be the more male way of 24/7 and putting your, as you said before, putting the career before the family, then we're kind of edging women out of being defined as having decent careers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think to me, truly, that's the fun of it. The back third of our book is all about the different wild and wonderful stories we heard from the hundreds of men and women we got to talk to. And the examples of the crazy wild things that men came up with, which, you know, I certainly would never have thought of, and their spouses who were telling us about it never would have thought of, was wonderful. We had a father who was talking about dealing with a son who really didn't like doing his math homework, and the mom had been at it in five different ways recommended by the school, and the father said, well, what does he really love? He loves Star Wars. So let's figure out how to make math about Star Wars. So he did that. And I'm sure we all look around and we see these situations where, again, just because men are women and women are more often trading roles, you just get much more innovation and, I think, fun out of it.
What are some of the other myths about work and home that you have come in contact with?
Well, one thing we talk a lot about is this idea that success requires 24/7. That's certainly the way of looking at things I grew up in, again, coming out of banking and technology. And, you know, I think what I have learned as a manager in both of those worlds, that, you know, that doesn't necessarily need to be the case. And in fact, if you start to look at what business schools are saying in their research, they're saying that things like structured, focused teamwork matter far more than hours at your desk. They say that having women as half the room really changes the decision-making dynamic. And so investing in strategies that allow more women to be in decision-making roles with men really changes the quality of the outcomes of the work. And finally, you know, to serve your customers or your shareholders, any constituency at work, you need to keep your stars, your best people. And increasingly, those are working parents. So I think we are in the beginning of a wonderful rethink of both how can we create excellence that's measurable because we are all competing in a very complex and changing world economy, but also be sensible about how our best people can put in their best performance and still do right by their families.
You mentioned the phrase having half the women in the or half the people in the room be women, and it got me thinking a little bit about the difference, I guess, between choice and pressure, because it seems like there are certain professions or certain kinds of things, I guess, where women just may not be as interested as men, but they may feel pressured to get into those fields so that they can be perceived as more powerful or as good role models for other women. Do you think that those exist? I mean, because you never hear anybody saying that there should be more women as roofers or dealing with hazardous waste or, you know, the kinds of things where it's 99% men.
Well, actually, just to be clear, I do think that becoming a roofer or doing hazardous waste or working in construction are great things for women to do. Because I think, again, if you look across the economy, you look at, you know, people who, you know, don't have a lot of economic advantage and, you know, perhaps don't get to go to college, and look at the kinds of jobs, there's big gender stratification in terms of what the girls think they can do. They'll, you know, if there's more often, they will go into professions where the pay scale is lower versus becoming an electrician or a construction worker or something like that. And if you go into the sphere of college graduates, you get into something that we talk about a lot here in the Bay Area, which is, for example, women and technology. And, you know, something, you know, in fact, even this week, I'm thinking about, I've got a daughter who's 9, who's awfully good at math. I loved math as a kid. I had a dad who really encouraged that. But I'm worrying that she, like me, hangs out with a lot of really wonderful smart girls who, you know, increasingly love literature. It's great to love literature, and love history and love even politics. But the idea of being on the math team seems just like not what you do if you're a girl. And it's this, there's lots and lots of research out of places like Carnegie Mellon and Stanford that says the reason so many girls who like math in grade school and high school and even college pull away from math and computer science is really social. They somehow, it's not just, you know, it's not cool for girls. It's, you know, the boys who I'm hanging out with seem not to like to talk. They don't talk to each other. They don't talk to me. I don't want to be in that group. And so it's very interesting, subtle dynamics that cause women to pull out of things like computer science. You know, we see some vaguely similar things in finance. And so I think, again, one of the frontiers for all of us is when our daughters or sons say they don't want to do X kind of job because, you know, they don't like the social dynamics, but they do like the work. So really double click on that and say, is there something that could be changed about the social dynamics so that you can continue to work you like, but shift the social dynamics by, say, finding peers who are more like you?
Sharon Mears is the co-author with Joanna Strober of Getting to 50-50, How Working Parents Can Have It All. It's a fascinating book. I think we're going to have you back on again. Talk about this some more. Sharon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Armin.
At 4:15 p.m. at an office in Michigan, Angie Hicks is not at her desk. She's giving blood at the company blood drive.
At the same time in the same office, Kevin Meehan is not at his desk. He's at the doctor. Kevin has cancer and needs another round of chemo.
Kevin will need blood to fight his cancer.
Angie's blood will help him win.
When you give blood to the American Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-GIVE-LIFE or visit givelife.org to schedule your appointment to give blood.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and joined at this particular time, as you know already, with Sam Fuse, and she's my co-author on the Parents at Play column, and we're going to talk a little bit about toys for boys, because Sam's got a boy. Seems like she's the perfect person to talk about these things, and I get to do all the toys for girls. What do you got? What's your son been playing with these days?
Oh, what hasn't he been playing with recently? He's into everything right about now. He's at that fun age where he's exploring everything. But his new favorite thing has been this horrific toy called the Ugly's Pug Electronic Pet, which is full of gas, and it farts and burps and tones these things for you. It's really disgusting, and he is just in love with it.
That sounds like that Doggy Doo thing we talked about a couple of weeks ago that people seem to love so much.
Yeah, this might actually be a little grosser. Doggy Doo just makes poo. This is pretty interesting. I kind of want to bring it out for you and let you hear its gaseousness, and or gaseousness rather. You can change the tone and the volume and how long, and whether it's burping or passing gas, and it's a real instrument of gas. Let me tell you.
What do you think that's about? There's so many of those things. I mean, there's the Doggy Doo thing, and then there's the gooey Louie that we talked about with the things hanging out of his nose. And why is it that kids are so attracted to such gross stuff? And then why do parents who aren't as attracted, why do they buy it?
Honestly, I don't think it's kids so much as boys. Having been a teacher, a parent, a nanny, all these fun things, it's the boys that like the really disgusting things most of the time, and their daddies love it too. My husband, his friends, every male that has come near this thing has just been in love with it, laughed at it, and played with it himself. So it didn't matter if it was my 6-year-old, my 32-year-old husband, whoever it was, whoever touched this toy was just laughing their head off at it. Girls were kind of like, oh, that's nice. It's the daddies and the sons. And I think that mommies buy these things because we love our children.
And you think that that sort of fits in the same general category as the trash pack wheels junkyard, which is also kind of, well,
yeah,
it doesn't smell as bad, but it could be sort of in that theme of yucky stuff.
Yeah, it's yucky stuff. There's nothing, it doesn't smell bad. It's not physically sticky or you know, noxious to touch. There's nothing about it that would, you know, turn you off in any of your senses. It's more of a visual. Like, it's got, like, the gooey look to it, dirty look to it, and it's ugly. It's not nothing that's, you know, visually appealing.
Yeah.
Like an old moldy sock or dirty bananas, little dirty rats with, like, dirty feet and moldy tails. And, like, it's gross stuff, and they come with garbage trucks, garbage cans, those big industrial bins that, you know, you see outside of restaurants and things like that, toxic waste canisters, and they keep coming out with new items for this trash pack, and every single one's been a hit.
So we've got the snips and snails and puppy dogs' tails and mud and yucky stuff. And then there's also, I guess, goes along the stereotypical thing about boys is the fighting and the battling. And there was one that I had a chance to take a look at actually at Toy Fair a while ago, tested it out a couple of times. And you had a closer look at it with your husband and your son with the...
Well, we actually battled together at Toy Fair the Beyblade.
Oh, that's true. The Beyblade, Shogun Steel Octagon Showdown Battle Set. I wish people would come up with shorter names for these things, but...
I know. So, it's just such a long... And if you Google it, you actually have to Google the entire name to come up with that particular set.
Oh, so you'll have to get that from the website.
Yeah.
So how did the boys like it?
Yeah, he loved it. It's really a fun set. It comes with two, an orange and a red figure that you stick the cord into and pull out, and it spins and spins, and they kind of smash into each other in the arena. And you do need something that contains them. If you don't have the arena, if you choose just to buy the figurines, it's not going to work on carpeting. You're not going to want it on your nice tile table or anything glass because it'll scratch it up. If you have maybe a laminate floor, that might work, but they're going to go all over the place. The battle dome keeps them together and smashing into each other until one of them falls over, and the one that falls over first is the loser.
And they've got these kind of zip tie things that you stick it in and you yank it out.
Little area and you just pull it out and it zips them along.
And they bounce around on each other for quite a while.
Yeah, they really do. They go at it for, you know, it's about a minute, which is actually a really long time for one twirl. And my husband and son both really liked the toy. I played with it a few times and, you know, it's like, okay, I'm sort of done with this. I kept playing until, you know, I had to go do something else because, you know, you're mommy and you play. But my husband really enjoyed it. My son loved it. My son must have played with it for 3 hours.
Yeah.
The first time he had it open.
Wow.
He just kept going and going. And his friends have come over and played with the toy, requested the toy. I think he actually has one friend that only plays with him because he wants to play with that toy. It's an interesting conversation we're going to have soon. The kids are really... they really like this toy, and you can buy additional battlers, which are not too expensive. And they come in different colors, different styles, things like that. It's a good set to have, and there's no physical fighting with them. Like, your kids are not actually putting their hands in, or they're not actually touching each other.
Right.
And they can't do, like, the Power Ranger thing of kicking and punching each other later on. Like, this is, you know, you can't swirl around and punch people for too long without, you know, falling over. So it's not something they're going to imitate later on, which I, as a mommy, really like.
Well, we've got reviews of a lot of other toys for boys and, of course, toys for girls as well, and pretty much anybody you could possibly want a toy for. And that's all at parentsatplay.com. For Samantha Fuse, I'm Armin Brandt.
Hands can do incredible things. This is the sound of two hands helping to save a life. It's called hands-only CPR, and it's recommended by the American Heart Association. If an adult suddenly collapses, call 911, then push hard and fast in the center of their chest until help arrives. Hands can do incredible things, but nothing compares to using them to help save a life. For more information on this latest method of CPR, visit handsonlycpr.org today. A message from the American Heart Association and the Ad Council.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brandt from the MrDad.com radio network.
Welcome back to the second part of today's Positive Parenting Show on AFN. I'm Armin Brandt. I want to take a minute and describe to you a particular type of child. This is a child who's got a really fascinating combination of what sounds like completely contradictory traits. So you've got a child who's highly creative and extremely energetic and maybe even gifted. And the same child has a need for fairness and honesty, but doesn't have a whole lot of respect for authority, has even less respect for the rules, and above all, wants special treatment. The same child likes to play alone, but also is looking for meaningful friendships. She can get totally focused on something to the exclusion of everything else, but also sometimes leaves projects completely unfinished. Now, if you've just listened to all that, you may be thinking to yourself, well, gee, that describes almost every kid around, completely contradictory, cold one day, hot the next day. But what I'm describing actually is a particular type of child called an indigo child. And they require a special type of parenting with a special type of energy put into it. And in this part of today's show, we're going to be talking, of course, about indigo children and how to raise them. But we're going to be looking specifically at how to get them to channel that energy in healthy ways. And we're going to be talking about how you, as a parent or a teacher, will be able to create more harmony in your home or your classroom. Because indigos really and truly can be extraordinary children if they're taught how to manage their energy and how to nurture the skills that they need to be successful. We'll jump right into all that and a lot more right after this. I'm Armin Brandt, and you're listening to Positive Parenting.
People have all kinds of excuses for not saving energy. I'll turn it off later, so we don't have those Energy Star appliances.
Well, maybe it's time to stop making excuses and save the energy and resources we can.
You just never know what people will need in the future.
We can all help save more energy for tomorrow. What's your excuse? For more energy-saving tips that also save money, visit loseyourexcuse.gov/parents. This message is brought to you by the U.S. Department of Energy, the Ad Council, and this station.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brandt, and my guest for this part of today's show is Maureen Dawn Healy, who's the author of The Energetic Keys to Indigo Kids, Your Guide to Raising and Resonating with the New Children. Maureen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so this hopefully won't sound too terribly ignorant. The word indigo, I for some reason had associated with gay.
Okay.
But mostly because I think the rock group, the Indigo Girls, who were a gay couple, and not that that makes any difference at all, but it just sort of got me along those lines. So why don't you tell us what an indigo child is from your perspective?
Right. Well, we're all probably very familiar with the concept of highly sensitive children, and that's a big umbrella that consists of lots of different kids. The mainstream parents and adults would call them highly sensitive. More metaphysical people would the kids that are not only highly sensitive but strong-willed and share a similar mindset, like, you know, they want things to be fair and they need to be partnered with, and it can go on and on. those are indigo children. And the reason why they call the word indigo is because it's connected to the third eye or the energy center that has to do with intuition, and that is an indigo color. And these kids have all the regular intelligences people do, but their primary intelligence is intuitive.
And how does that work, though, with the assertiveness?
Well, they have a high level of energy and a high level of intensity. So they have an inner wisdom. They know what's right and what's not right. And opposed to decades ago where kids were more programmable, you know, if you said go in your room, do your homework, kids did that even if they didn't want to. Nowadays, there's kids who say, I absolutely will not. So they need to be raised in a new way.
What kind of new way is that? It seems because, you know, we're slicing the kinds of kids that we have so thin that everybody's going to need special treatment. So what does that mean for these kids, for the new children?
Well, adults or parents and caregivers and teachers who have these children, you know, are nodding their heads because they'll know that they have children who are highly sensitive and who have an intensity to them that's unlike others. So, you know, it's from the standpoint of helping them succeed in life and having a more harmonious home and classroom, they need to be partnered with versus just being told, you know, do this because I said so. So in other words, the way that they really can do well in this world is they have more of a partnership approach from adults, and there's more and more things, you know, involved in this, but that's just a key piece of the puzzle.
Okay. Tell us a little bit more about, I guess, a portrait of an indigo child. I mean, the kind of energy that they've got, how it happens. I mean, is it a hereditary thing? Is it just happen randomly? What's going on with them?
You know, there are children that are just born with a high level of energy, a high level of intensity, and they're born that way. It's not like one day there's a magic wand and they become that way. Usually adults notice, you know, would call them, a lot of mainstream adults would call them hyperactive or would call them difficult or challenging because they won't just go along with everything sometimes. They really do want to do what they want to do. And so they have this high level of energy. They're very sensitive. The key piece is sensitivity and stubbornness or intensity to them. And the sensitivity is not only sensitive to the energy of a room, to feelings, to sensory input, light, sound, smells. It's sensitive to what they eat and their physical bodies. And so they have a different composition than maybe a quote-unquote normal or regular kid, meaning, say, one kid falls off the swings at a playground. He maybe can just get up and shake it off. A highly sensitive kid or an indigo kid might just start crying. So there's a difference in reaction and responsiveness to the world.
That seems almost like contradictory things, though, that the sensitivity, I think a lot of people would associate sensitivity with shyness and withdrawing, and you're saying that there's the sensitivity that goes along with an assertiveness. Is that?
I wouldn't use the word assertive. I would use intense. So that would mean someone who could be very shy but have a stubbornness to them, meaning they would say they want to become a scientist, and even if their parents want them to be a lawyer, they're going to be a scientist. You know, there's sort of a intensity and stubbornness to them. They want to do what they want to do. And, you know, the key piece of the puzzle there is also to help them channel their energy for good because their energy is fast moving, much more fast than other kids. So it can go in a direction that's really healthy and skillful quickly, or it can go in another direction, which is why, you know, I wrote the book, The Energetic Keys to Indigo Kids. And my website is Growing Happy Kids because I work with parents and children all over who have these children who are sensitive yet stubborn and strong-willed and oftentimes don't know what to do with them. So there are certain ways to help them thrive.
Well, what are some of those ways? Because I'm really intrigued by this whole thing because there are so many, as obviously you can tell, I do a parenting radio show and I get tons and tons of books. And there's has been over the past, I don't know, 5-6 years or so, kind of this trend towards taking a small group of children, whether it's autistic children or kids with ADD or other kinds of characteristics, and then making that into a real positive. Not that it's not a positive, but to sort of make that, you know, there's a lot of talk about how they're extremely creative and they have, things like that. So how is this working in the grand scheme of child rearing?
Well, I think that it's important that we look at the children who we have and we say, how can we help them succeed, which I think is why we're going from, you know, raising kids all the same to realizing that every child needs something slightly different. If we have the opportunity and time to do that, that's going to help them the most because, you know, kids aren't all the same and that everything, like you said, can be turned into a positive. There can be some growth and learning and, you know, even if you have, you know, some hyperactivity and some, oftentimes indigo children are labeled ADD or ADHD because they need to learn how to focus their energies and how to complete things because they're so smart, they'll complete something in their mind, but they don't see any value with handing in that piece of homework into school. So there is sort of like a guidance and a mentoring that needs to happen with their younger child who has someone who's older who has those sensitivities who's learned how to be successful with them, because if they don't, it could be a handicap, it could be a problem, it could be a challenge.
Seems like there could also be a challenge between a non-indigo kind of a parent or somebody who's wired completely differently and that kind of a child.
Absolutely. Oftentimes I have one adult who is tuned into the child and the other adult or parent says, I have no idea who this child is. It feels like a Martian dropped them off. So, yeah, I mean, oftentimes it's really just sort of being able to see them with new eyes and to understand who they really are and what their mindset and what their behavior is and what their energy is like so that we can help them manage their emotions, manage their energy, and really help them develop skills, not only what they're interested in, but life skills.
Do you think that these kids need to be told what the issue is with them, that there's an explanation that goes along with it, that we see that you have these particular characteristics and we need you to work with us? Because it's not only going to be obviously about the parents changing their behavior. There's going to have to be
right.
some sort of acknowledgement on the part of the kid that you may need some different coping skills than you've heard of from other people.
Right. I mean, indigos know they're different. They've always been different. They realize they're usually the odd girl or boy out unless they're with other sensitive souls, other creative types. And it can be across all discipline, their interests, but they know they're different. They look at things differently. So then when they're around those other kids or in environments or school systems that really help them thrive, that are creative and imaginative, then they can really thrive and normalize themselves. They don't think that, oh, there's something wrong with me. I don't fit in. You know, they can really appreciate that difference is good. You know, different children and different ways to learn and different ways to perceive things can really be an advantage. So I think when they learn that what their skills are good and they are really accepted for who they are and that we want to see them succeed, they do gain a sense of confidence and ease and realize, okay, I need to figure this emotional thing out. I have an intensity. Mm-hmm. I get really angry. Maybe I need to learn how to pause and take deep breaths and do all sorts of different things to not react so quickly.
You talk about how indigos must express their emotions. Is that something that you're going to work with these kids to say, look, I understand that you really want to express your emotions, but there are certain times when you can't?
Yeah. I mean, I think even if, that's a key piece is that you need to help them manage their emotions, right? They always need to express them, but expressing them might be writing in a journal. It doesn't mean they need to, you know, scream. So helping them manage and express their emotions in ways that are healthy for them, whether it's taking deep breaths or whether it's saying, hey, I'm really angry right now, even just putting words to it better than sort of hitting someone in class, you know, which happens when they're very little oftentimes. I've had many preschools who have hit another kid because they didn't have any other emotional tools. They just didn't know what was available to them. So as we teach them how to, you know, manage their energy and emotions, things go better.
Maureen Dawn Healy is the author of Energetic Keys to Indigo Kids, Your Guide to Raising and Resonating with the New Children. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue talking with Maureen. Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Maureen Dawn Healy, who's the author of Energetic Keys to Indigo Kids, Your Guide to Raising and Resonating with the New Children. We were talking a little bit about some of the positives and negatives. I'm curious, I came across a part in the book, which I thought was really interesting. Common issues having to do with indigo kids, video game addiction, violence, bullying others, and addiction as they grow. That's interesting, though, the addiction part of it especially.
Well, I mean, the thing is that they are highly sensitive. And, you know, we live in a highly unsensitive world sometimes. So anyone with deep sensitivity needs to either learn how to manage their sensitivity, or they certainly have the tendency to want to, you know, medicate themselves. So it's just something to be aware of, that indigos have such a sensitivity and such fast-moving energy that it can go in a direction that we would consider healthy and skillful, or the opposite.
You talk about also something I think I've come across in with a lot of kids is being wise beyond their years. How do you experience that? You as an individual, I mean, how do you process what that looks like?
Certainly, I've worked with children who have said things that were amazing, and I've actually even worked with kids who remember past lives and other really metaphysical things that aren't mainstream. But, I mean, I have just experienced children who just, they got it. They came into this world with a sense of wisdom. Not that they know everything. Of course, they need judgment, and they need guidance, and they need to, you know, cognitively develop and all sorts of different things. But when I see a child who has, like, this old soul look in them, and that they sort of carry themselves with an awareness, that's pretty impressive.
Getting back to the energy for just a second, you talk about different kinds of energy, mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between those energies?
Sure. I mean, everything is energy. We know that. And the idea is to help children manage their energy so they have a wellspring of energy, not just thoughts, but physical energy, emotional energy, you know, spiritual energy, whether they believe in God or they believe in a higher power, they look at the universe and they're at awe, they have an energy of connecting to something greater. And they need, every day, children need to channel their energy. And if it goes unchanneled, they can stay stuck in their body, whether that means whether that means they start to feel sad, or there are different things that can happen. For example, the emotional energy. If they don't allow their frustrations out, that's why I like journaling so much, or I like them connecting with a way to allow their feelings and emotions out, because it just keeps them clear and free and healthy.
Maureen, talk a little bit about the energetic triggers that you talk about. They're essentially potholes that parents could step in, or things that are going to get a child to go off in a direction that we don't want him or her to go. What are they?
Yeah, there's a whole big list, but particularly with indigo kids, since they have a high level of sensitivity and intensity, and they have a similar mindset. So some of their things in their mindset are that they really want to be treated fairly and equally. And that doesn't matter if you're their parent or their principal. If they think something's unfair, they're going to let you know. So if there is a perception of unfairness, that would be a trigger for them. So if mom was pouring, you know, two bowls of Cheerios, one for daughter one, one for daughter two, and the indigo kid said, oh, my, I don't have as many Cheerios as my sister does, she, you know, perceives that unfairness, and that could be a trigger. So it's being aware and sensitive to their perception, whether it's needing for fairness, needing equality, needing their voices heard. Oftentimes, they also can be triggered by just sensory overload, right? So,
sure.
You know, going into a crowded space and they just, it's too much for them to handle. So really being aware of not only triggers with, you know, their mindset, but also the energy around them, and helping them really learn how to manage their sensitivities and their perspective on the world so that they can bring their unique gifts here.
So, yeah, I want to get back to that, because I think it's such an important point about working with them, that it, from what I was reading, it sounded a little bit like you were saying that we need to kind of be tiptoeing around them, but I was glad to hear you say that it's also helping the kids to understand that they may react in a certain way that doesn't necessarily reflect the reality that everybody else sees.
Right, but it's a real reality for them, you know what I mean? So the idea is to help them understand, like even just something simple like waiting in line. They have no patience typically. They can't stand it. And listen, I don't want to wait in line either, but the way planet Earth works is we got to wait in line. We want to buy a pizza. You know, you wait in line, you pay for it, you go home. Sort of validating what they're thinking and then helping them manage their emotions and their energy and realize that, hey, this is how things work here. It's not perfect. I want it to be perfect, But what, you know, is going to make you happy, and we all want to be happy, is to give our best and then let go of the rest. So they really do need that guidance and mentoring. And if someone has similar sensitivities, whether it's a teacher, a therapist, a parent, you know, it helps them understand how they can navigate their way. Maybe they don't go to the mall during Christmas time because it's just going to give them a meltdown. Or maybe you don't force them to go to a birthday party because they can't stand, you know, the birthday song. I mean, they have quirks, too. Oftentimes, they're very quirky.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I think a lot of parents have discovered along their route, and it's not every parent with every child, but negotiating can be a real minefield sometimes. I mean, certain kids you can negotiate with, and certain kids it's just better not even to get in there because you're going to lose as an adult.
Right.
And you talk a lot about in the book about negotiation and how to do it. So how do you negotiate with a kid who's a born litigator?
Well, not only a born litigator, like you're just super smart. They can see through you. They know your buttons and they know how to push them. But the thing is, they really want to be treated fairly. They prize honesty and fairness almost above all else. So if you're fair with them, they're willing to negotiate, meaning if you really need help setting the table because you're having a nice dinner with some friends over and they really want a half an hour extra screen time, then maybe you can just negotiate. There's so much under the sun that's negotiable. And, of course, there's other places where it's not negotiable. You know, you have to brush your teeth. You have to go to bed. There's certain things you need to do, but you can give them choices oftentimes. Like, okay, you do your homework now or you do it after dinner. You know, they just need to have a sense of a choice that they're not forcing them into things usually doesn't work out well. Or being an authoritarian parent saying, you got to do this because I said so, versus partnering with them and say, hey, I need to do this. You need to do this. How can I make it work for you? How can we together really come together and make it work versus just do this? And I understand as a parent, we're exhausted sometimes. It takes more effort to partner with children. But the good news is if we partner in the beginning, it's less meltdowns and less triggers. So it's learning these habits and really employing a few techniques that in the beginning may feel like a little extra energy, but save so much sort of heartache at the end.
It's so hard, though, I think. I mean, we can read this book in the luxury of our own relaxed time. The kids have already gone to bed. We can read it and say, this sounds like a really great thing. But at some point, despite all of our best intentions, we all get to a point where you just want to say to the kid, just do it because I said so, without having to negotiate or without having to go through this whole dance with them. Just say, it's enough already.
Right. But sometimes, we can also make mistakes as parents and teachers and adults and say, all right, well, maybe I shouldn't have said that, and I'm sorry that got you upset. But, we're growing and learning together. So I think it is important that we realize this is a dimension of our own growth in parenting. I mean, what better way for the universe to help expand our ability to love than to love someone who's screaming or being difficult or pain? How can we guide them? And that also heals us when we were, those young moments we had as little kids where someone said, just go in your room and do that. I mean, that doesn't feel good for anyone, really.
No.
But life is practice, right? We practice. It's not about perfection.
Don't you worry, though, that you're kind of relinquishing your authority as the parent, that there does need to be a hierarchy of some sort? You can't treat your child like an equal. And by entertaining them with negotiating about things, you're kind of raising them in a way to an equal partner in the whole child-rearing thing.
Well, I mean, you are their authority because you are their parent. That's not going to change. But there's an awful lot that a parent and a child can learn together. And to give them a voice and a choice is all that children want. They want to be heard. They want to be able to express talent. And there's a lot of ways that we can partner with them to help them have a happy life and help us have a happy life. And there's other moments where we say, hey, you know what? This is the way it is. I'm sorry. This is just part of the family. This is, there are times that we have to stand tall because they are kids. They're not adults. They don't have the luxury of experience. They haven't gone through everything that adult has gone through. So they don't have that awareness per se, but they do have an awful lot of feeling and an emotional depth to them. And oftentimes a real good intelligence that I think as adults we need to honor.
Maureen Dawn Healy is the author of The Energetic Keys to Indigo Kids, Your Guide to Raising and Resonating with the New. Maureen, thanks very much for joining us. It was great to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.